All right, Zos HaBracha. I'll tell you why I wanted to do Parsha as opposed to Yom Kippur, because I never learned this Parsha. This is the Parsha which is never read on Shabbos. Zos HaBracha, the final Parsha, is always reserved for Simchas Torah. That's when we read it. All the men get aliyahs for the first half of the Parsha, and then we communally complete the end of the Parsha on Simchas Torah. And we begin Bereishis the following Shabbos. So there's no official Shabbos that gets this Parsha. And therefore, it's very often, it's not really learned in any serious way, because it's hard. Yontif comes, it goes, you don't spend the time doing it. So I didn't want to lose the opportunity to do so. It's very, very rich. The Parsha is, in effect, the final blessings of Moshe to the Jewish people before he dies. And as such, it's a very, very rich parsha with a lot of insight. It's the completion. It's the last verses of the Chumash. I don't want to call it a highlight, but one of the major discussions in all of Torah is on the last 8 psukim from this parsha, in which Moshe describes his own death, which of course has a major discussion in the Talmud. How do we have Moshe writing the last 8 verses which describe his own death? And a big dispute there. There's a lot of fascinating discussions in the Torah, primarily the blessings given to each tribe. What I wanted to do today is work through the 5 introductory psukim, the 5 introductory verses which lead up to the blessings of the individual tribes. So that the parsha begins with a couple of verses, and then by the 6th pasuk already begins describing tribe by tribe different things that were said to them, different blessings. So I'd like to focus this morning a little bit on the 4 or 5 psukim leading up to that. And we'll see if we could find a way to weave that into the Yom Kippur theme. This coming Shabbos, of course, will be Yom Kippur. So we're not going to read the parsha then. And then 5 days later, next Wednesday night, will be Sukkos. So that Shabbos is going to be Chol HaMoed. We have a special Sukkos reading on that Shabbos. And then the following Shabbos will be Simchas Torah. We'll read this. We're not going to read this parsha for a full. What is that?
Simchas Torah is on Friday. Shabbos is.
Bereishis already. So we'll read this parsha thing. We'll read this parsha Friday, 2 weeks from now. We'll finally get to 2.5 weeks from now. We will finally get to this parsha. So it's a little bit in advance, but we'll try to use it as a tie-in to Yom Kippur as well for this coming week. That's Hashem. Bereishis also, I'm just going to comment now because we're not going to get together. We will not have a chance to have a class on Bereishis. I always remember thinking from the time I was in yeshiva many, many years ago, Bereishis is one of the most packed parshios in all of Chumash. And just within this one parsha, each one of the 6 days of creation, the 7 days of creation, is a study unto itself. The words, and it's hard to understand. Chazal didn't want us to understand what the Torah is telling us with creation. Then you have the creation of man, the creation of woman. You have the sin of man and woman. You have with the whole snake. You have the birth of Cain and of Hevel, and they're killing each other, the two brothers. Their expulsion from the garden. There is just so many different themes, and every year is very similar to this year. There's no time to prepare it. Simchas Torah is going to be on Thursday, Friday, 2 days of Yontif. Friday being Simchas Torah. Shabbos is already Bereishis, and then it's on to Noach the next week. So it's interesting to me the way the calendar works itself out, the way that the sages establish this, that one parsha with so many of the secrets of the Torah in it, the secrets of creation, very rarely actually studied in the weekly format that is normally done. There's just no time for it because of the way that it's done right from Yontif. You go right into Bereishis. You can make a study out of it, out of a class, but in a weekly setting like we have for this, it almost never gets done that there's a class on Bereishis with all that there is in there. So Zos HaBracha also almost never gets done, so I didn't want to give up this opportunity either. Alright, enough of the introductions. Let us begin. Okay, so the parasha begins on page 1112. The Zos HaBracha. This is the blessings Asher Berach Moshe Ish HaElokim Es Bnei Yisrael. These are the blessings that Moshe, the Ish HaElokim, the man of God, blessed, bestowed upon the children of Israel, Lefnei Mosel, before his death. So, interestingly, you have first of all the description of Moshe Rabbeinu as a Ish HaElokim. Moshe is described as a man of God, which is a tremendous appellation to give to somebody, to be able to define him on his final day, his final hours of life, and say, this was an Ish HaElokim, a man of God, something that we all certainly yearn and strive to be, to fulfill, that we can say our lives were so dedicated as such that we were men and women of God. But that's as Moshe is described. This is not the only place he is described, but it is certainly a fitting description for Moshe. And when does he bless the Jewish people? He blesses them, the Torah describes, lefnei moso, before his death. So Rashi comments on the words lefnei moso. It's the very first Rashi on the page here. Rashi says, samuch lemisa, so meaning right before he died, he bestowed these blessings. She'im lo achshav, for if not now, Mosai. Well, when are you going to do it? If not now, when? The famous statement Rashi's borrowing from Pirkei Avot. In lo achshav, Mosai. If you're not going to do it now, when are you going to do it? So Rashi borrows that to describe why did Moshe bless the people now? Because if he's not going to do it now, well then when is he going to do it? He's about to die. Now I want to share with you a fascinating Maharal. The Maharal was bothered by this because the Maharal says it seems from Rashi that Moshe purposely held off blessing the people. He held off, he had what to say. He held off, he held off, he held off. And now he got to the point in which he said to himself, well, if not now, when am I going to do it? I'm about to die. And if Moshe would have lived another 10 years, what's the implication from the discussion in the Chumash and from Rashi? It sounds like had Moshe lived another 10 years, he wouldn't have blessed them now. He would have said, he had what to say, clearly. But he only did it because he got to that point of, well, if I don't do it now, I'm going to lose my chance. So the Maharal was bothered, if Moshe has all of these beautiful blessings to bestow upon the Jewish people, why does he feel it necessary to wait until the day of his death? Why does he have to wait until the point in which he says, I cannot wait any longer, I must bless you now, because if I miss this chance, it will be forever gone. You could have done it a long time ago. So the Maharal says the following idea.
Moshe, I think maybe
Hashem
would change his mind and let him
well. Doesn't seem that way. The question that the Maharal is addressing is why did he wait? No, it's because there's a concept here that says if I knew I had more time, I wouldn't do this now. I'm only doing this now because this is my last chance. Well, if you have a nice thing to say to somebody, if you have a blessing you want to bestow upon them, why would you wait till the very little? Do it earlier. Let him hear it beforehand. So the Maharal says as follows. Listen to this, Maharal. Says the Maharal. Mipnei, why did he wait to the last moment? Shekein ro'oi lefarnes lehoichiach tamid es doro. It is appropriate for a parnes. A parnes is a leader of a generation, a person in charge, a rabbi of sorts, the person who is directing and controlling the congregation. It is proper for him to lehoichiach tamid, to constantly rebuke his generation. Why is it so appropriate for him to give rebuke? Shemikayach rov hatoichacho, because of the force of all of the rebuke, lo yischotu, they won't sin. They're going to be kept on the straight and narrow, because whenever they veer, so then the person says, back over there. That's not appropriate. You got to go like this. Keeps you in line. The ilu hayo mevarech osam, and had the leader, in this case Moshe, blessed them, the people would have viewed themselves as important and righteous individuals. Look, Moshe Rabbeinu said to me, how wonderful I am. And that would lead them to sin. That would lead them astray. Fascinating insight, says the Maharal. And we'll talk. I want to talk in a moment how we view this in today's world in psychology of 2007. The Maharal says the leader of the generation, his role is to rebuke. His role is to instruct. His role is to guide and to put back on the right path. Because if not, then the people go in their own direction. That's the way of the world. So to bless, says the Maharal, would give everybody the impression of how good they are, how important they are, how righteous they are. And once a person is inflated with that sense, well, then they're going to go off. And he backs this up with the Gemara. The Gemara says in Maseches Ksuvos, that a rabbi who is well liked by his congregation, the Gemara says, you know for sure is not doing his job. That's what the Gemara says. Now, it's only said by a rabbi, not by an assistant rabbi. An assistant rabbi can be well liked by his congregation. That's totally okay. But a rabbi who is loved by everyone in his congregation, the Gemara says, then you know he's not doing his job. Because the job of the leader, the job of the spiritual director of a community, is not simple. People are always people. And people, including the rabbi himself, who also needs to have his rabbi, people do their own things. They're always driven by their own desires to do what they want to do. And his role is to, you know, put back in place and to guide and to instruct. So if he's too well-liked, that means he's not giving enough mussar. He's not instructing the people enough. He's not telling them where they need to be put in the straight and narrow. And the morale uses that as Moshe, that was his guidepost. I can't be blessing the people, telling them how great they are and how wonderful they are. That's not my job. My job is to put them on the straight and narrow. And therefore he saved the blessings for the very end. Fascinating insight. So the blessings were kept to the end, because until that year, all 40 of the other years, it was constant rebuke and constant mussar, making sure that people doing what they needed to do. So the reason why I find this so fascinating is because the day and age that we live in, so like Dr. Abram Tursky will tell you, everything is all about self-esteem. Everything is about a person feeling good about himself, about feeling that sense of self-worth, self-efficacy, being able to accomplish, being valuable. And it's an interesting concept. What we have today, the theories that we deal with are, you must praise. You must tell people that they're worthwhile. You must build up, because the way that we're starting off so low, I don't know if it was different, you know, back then when Moshe was functioning, that people didn't have that, I think we do today, in which our natural default position is one in which we feel so low and so poor about ourselves that we constantly need to be built up by parents and teachers. But certainly today, I would say, you know, most Rabbanim do toe a line in between the two of being able to give rebuke, and on the other hand, constantly lavishing out praise in terms of making people, congregants, constituents, feeling that they are successful and feeling good about oneself. But it is an interesting Maharal in which he describes that the reason why Moshe waited to the very end was because of the fact that his job was to be a mochiach, his job was to give rebuke and mussar, and he saved the blessings for the very end, the last day of his life. Comments, questions?
I'm thinking of Rabbi Elan as you're talking. Mm-hmm. He does it.
So it does it in terms of the balance.
Yeah.
Yeah, that is the general, you know, the feeling of today's psychology. That's how it works. It's a balance between I love you and you're great, and you're not doing this well enough. That if I don't tell you I love you and you're great beforehand, you're not going to listen to me when I tell you. Now, it could be that that's really the answer. It could be that Moshe himself, who was so full of the love of the Jewish people and was such an established leader, didn't need to win over his congregants to be able to give them the rebuke. They would hear it from him without that. But in today's world, the leader needs to win over the confidence, security of the people in order to be able to say the rebuke. That's why it's a little different where we have that balance. But it is a fascinating insight. However we practice it today, the concept is eternal. The idea of the role of the leader is rebuke. And in order to be able to do that, that's how you need to do that. And you can't allow the people to feel complacent and too successful so that they no longer feel the need to watch where they're going. However, that's accomplished might change in terms of what people need to hear, but the idea, the concept always remains true. You need to be on the lookout. You need to be wary of where you're stepping and never feel too complacent and confident, because with confidence and complacency always comes a veering from what one needs to be doing. That will always remain true. Alright, that's all in this first pasuk here. V'zois HaBrocha, these are the blessings that Moshe blessed the people before he died. What does he say? Pasuk Beis, Vayoyimar, Hashem Misinai Bo. Hashem came from Sinai. There's a very poetic pasuk here. Follow it through. V'zorach Miseir Lomo, shown forth to them from Seir. Hofia mehar Paron, appeared from the mountain of Paron, ve'asa mirivos kodesh, and then approached with some of his holy myriads, mimino esh dos lomo. From his right hand, he presented the fiery Torah to them. so much in this pasuk. I mean, it doesn't even, you can't even read it in English. What does that mean? Where's the start? Where's the end? So there's a I'll start with the first half of the pasuk is problematic. How many places did Hashem come from? So we start from, he came from Sinai. Moshe begins his blessing by saying, like an introductory blessing. Moshe is about to bless the Jewish people, so he gives a brief introduction. Again, a short, not just a world history, but a presentation of Hashem having given us the Torah. So he starts with Hashem coming to us at Har Sinai, giving us the Torah. Except it sounds like it came from three separate places. Hashem came from Sinai. He's shown forth from Seir, which is a second place, and he appeared from Mount Paran, a third place. So this is the famous problem that the sages were bothered by. How many places did Hashem come to when he gave us the Torah? It sounds like it came from three places, from Sinai, from Seir, and from Paran. So this is the source of a famous statement of the sages, which you all know, and probably never knew where it came from. Maybe you did, but this is where it comes from. So, who lived in Seir? So Esau lived in Seir. Who lived in Paran? Yishmael lived in Paran. So the sages say, well, that's interesting. It sounds like Hashem gave us the Torah after having come from the children of Esau and after having come from the children of Yishmael. Why would he come to give us the Torah only after having come from Esau and Yishmael? This then is the source for the famous drasha, which we all know, that before Hashem gave the Jewish people the Torah, before doing that, what he did is he went around to all the other nations of the world. And first he offered it to the children of Esau, and he said, do you want my Torah? And they say, what's written in it? And he said, don't kill, or don't steal, or don't commit adultery. And they said, no thanks. And then he went to the children of Yishmael, and he said, do you want my... That famous statement, which you all know, which is said over every year in the time of Shavuos, the source of that is this verse in which the Torah says, when Hashem came to the Jewish people at Sinai, he came to them already from having been at Seir, which was the city, the place in which Esau lived, and from the place of Paran. He then approached them, continuing in Pasuk Beis. He then approached Trav with some of his holy myriads. We will leave that out for today's discussion. From his right hand, he presented the fiery Torah to them. So the Torah here is described as an Eshdos, the fiery Torah. What's the meaning of the fact that Hashem, Moshe introduces us to this idea that Hashem presented us a Torah with fire? So Rashi says two things. First thing that he says is that this is simply a description of the fact that when the Torah was given, there was thunder, there was lightning, there was smoke. It was given from within fiery circumstances. That's how the Torah was presented to the Jewish people. And then Rashi says something else. Rashi says, you know what the meaning of the fiery Torah being presented to the Jewish people? Shaisa ksuvo me'oz lefanav, it was written, the Torah was written before Hashem himself, be'esh shchoira, with a black fire, al gabe esh levana, on top of a white fire. So that there was instead of a piece of parchment, most of our books, so you have white paper, and black ink on top of the white paper, and here you have a book that you can read. Says Rashi, the meaning that the sages understood from the fact that the Torah was given in a fiery right hand is the meaning that the Torah itself was written on a white fire, and the black fiery letters were written on top of the white fire. That's what Rashi says. What does that mean? What is the significance of the fact that the Torah was written in fire, white on black? So the moral again here says something which I can't say over. He says it's a sod mufla, a wondrous hidden secret. So the reason why I can't say it over is not because it's a secret which I'm not allowed to reveal to you, but it's a secret which I can't possibly understand. So I'm not going to say over the whole thing because I don't get it. But what I do want to share is a little bit of the understanding that I have from the Maharal. What does it mean when the sages tell us that the Torah was written black fire on top of white fire? So the Maharal says the understanding of this is that fire has a fascinating quality to it, in that fire is not anything really physical and tangible. You can't touch fire. You can't hold it and move it. It somehow exists, a burning flame, but you could put anything right through it. You have a regular candle, a Shabbos candle, you could take anything and go right through it. There's nothing physical, tangible there. Yet there is something there. There's something clearly there. Look, there's a flame. Touch it, it hurts. It has the capacity to burn, and it burns up whatever it is that it's burning, be it a wick, be it oil. But the flame itself sort of balances in a world of physicality, yet is somehow intangible, somehow doesn't seem to occupy the space that it's in. So the Maharal says fire is the perfect mashal, the perfect parable for describing the Torah. The Torah, he says, seems to be something very physical, something dealing with our physical beings. Everything about the Torah, almost everything, deals with how we in our physical life need to act, how we behave, what we eat, how we dress, what we do, places we go. It's a very physical guideline, a series of things that tell us how to handle our lives in what would seem to be a very physical way. In reality, says the Maral, Ein HaDavar Kach. It's not really the truth. Even though it would seem that if one at first glance would look at the Torah and say, what is the Torah about? He would say, well, it's all about the physical existence of man. It tells us how to live and how to be and what to do and what to eat. Ein HaTorah Noisei Shelo Inyan Gashmi. The Torah is really not anything about the physical. And therefore, the description is that it's on a background of white fire. Because fire is not really something physical. And the white is representative of that which is pure and good. What is the definition of white? We're white on Yom Kippur because we want to exude purity. And the white is the person, that which a person is buried in, and his final tahar, and his final purity is always in pure white. So the white Torah represents that which is pure and that which is good. As the Torah is called a Torah Chesed, it's called the Torah of kindness, Darachecha Darchei Noam. We always sing every Shabbos as we take out the Torah. Its ways are ways of pleasantness. And that the concept of the goodness, the inherent goodness for the soul of the person. I think it was last week that we mentioned, we never like hearing the phrase, I know what's good for you. Whenever a parent tells us that, it's an immediate reaction that says, don't want to hear it, don't believe you, don't want to listen. When the divine says that, when we have in the Torah the concept of, I'm telling you this is what's good for you, it's a drachecha darchei noham. Its ways are ways of pleasantness. And you say, not pleasant. It's hard. Telling you that fasting on Yom Kippur is pleasant, it's not pleasant. It's extremely difficult, and it's extremely hard, and it's often painful. And there are a lot of the mitzvahs of the Torah which would seem to our experience to be difficult and hard. So the Maral says the Torah was written in a white fire, something which seems to be physical but is really intangible, something which is hard to grasp, which touches the soul, the concept of the ruchnius, of the spirituality of what the Torah is all about in terms of touching our lives, is fire, and it's a white fire to the purity and the goodness, the inherent wholeness and goodness of what the Torah has to teach us is the backdrop of the Torah, is the of the whiteness, and the black, he says, shachor, black, is always teaches you on that which is clear and concise, precise in its meaning. When you have something which is like etched in the blackness, so you have the backdrop of kindness, and on top of that is a black fire of everything about the Torah is clear and concise. We might not understand it, as I barely understand the words that I'm saying now, but he's trying to give us a little bit of an insight into the meaning of what the sages say when the Torah describes itself as being given in a fiery right hand of Hashem. But when the sages say that means it's a white fire, black fire on top of white fire, some of this meaning, a little bit of an insight, I probably understood it about as little as I do, as I'm the one saying it over, this concept of a Torah of goodness, of purity, that seems to be all physical, but in reality is very little about the physical and is all about the purity of soul and the spiritual growth that a person has. In any case, I just like saying things that are on a deeper level that don't fully get, and that's the meaning of that. Let's move on to something which we can understand a little bit more. Okay, verse 3, Pasuk Gimel. So moving on in Moshe's 5 Pasuk introduction to his blessings of the Jewish people. Af chovev amim kol kidoshav biyodecha. So Moshe says, indeed, you loved the tribes greatly. All of its holy ones were in your hands. So Moshe again describes, before he blesses all of the Jewish people, before he blesses each one of the tribes on their own, so he describes the giving of the Torah. Hashem came to us at Sinai, came to us at Har Sinai, gave us the Torah after offering it to the other nations, presented us a fiery Torah. He loved you, all of the holy ones that were in your hands. If they had planted themselves at your feet, bearing the yoke of their utterances, they sat before you at the foot of Har Sinai, listening to that which you had to teach them. You sat after he gave you the Torah to accept upon yourselves all the things that he had to teach. Okay, I don't want to focus on that pasuk. The next two psukim are the ones that I'd like to focus on for the duration of what we have today. What were the main things that we sat at the foot of Har Sinai hearing? What was that? The most famous pasuk possibly in all of Chumash says, Moshe Rabbeinu, Torah Tziva Lanu Moshe. Moshe taught us the Torah. Mo Rasha Kehilas Yaakov. It was an inheritance for the Kehilas Yaakov, the congregation of Yaakov. Famous, famous pasuk. Rashi says, "This. What does that mean? This Torah that Moshe taught us was a morasha, a yerusha. It was an inheritance, something which is handed down from generation to generation." Rashi says, "Ach zenuha v'lo na'azvena, something which we will take hold of and never let go. Something which we will grab onto and always hold onto." Now, this pasuk is quoted. I would use the word Google, but it's not quite a Google search on a Bar Ilan. Which has the database of all of the Torah and all of the Mefarshim. So I plugged this in to see where it comes up. I even didn't search all the databases, and it's over 70 different references amongst the Gemaras and the Midrashim, where the sages derive various things from this pasuk of Torah Tziva Lanu Moshe. And I wanted to share some of them just to see the way the sages understood the relationship that the Jewish people have to Torah through the way that this pasuk was constructed, how Moshe taught us the Torah, and it's an inheritance to the Kehilas Yaakov. So the first thing that I want to share is from Rashi from Shema. One of the psukim that we say in Shema is V'dibarta bam V'shivtecha b'veisecha V'lachtecha v'aderech. You should always speak in the words of the Torah along when you're traveling on your way, while you're sitting in your house. You need to speak bam, speak in them. So the sages say, what does that mean that you need to speak in them? That when a child begins to speak, tchilas diburo should be in Torah. The beginning of his speaking, you should teach him how to speak using the Torah. And the verse that the Gemara brings, that Rashi quotes, is this pasuk. The first thing that a child should be able to say when they learn to speak is Torah Tziva Lanu Moshe Morasha Kehilas Yaakov. This is the first thing that a child should be taught how to speak as he becomes of age, where he learns to begin to speak. This is the first thing that he says. This is the Torah that was taught to us, Morasha Kehilas Yaakov. Now, the Ramban points out that the phrase at the end of this pasuk is that the Torah belongs to the Kehilas Yaakov. The word Kehilah is an interesting word that was chosen. Most of the time when we describe the Jewish people, when we start from our forefathers, we describe them as Zera Avraham, the children of Avraham, Beis Yaakov, the house of Yaakov, describing this is a family thing. This is my family, and all of my children will share in this inheritance that I have. Or this is my house, the house of Yaakov, the Beis Yaakov. And here we don't describe it as a morasha, as an inheritance to the Beis Yaakov, but it's inheritance to the Kehilas Yaakov, to the congregation of Yaakov. So the Ramban points out why the word Kehila and not the word of Zera, the seed, the family, or the house of Yaakov. So the Ramban says, the Rami, this is to hint us, Shi'ikahalu Rabim Aleihem, that many other people will gather and join together. The word kahal means to join to combine onto the Jewish people. V'yitia ha-Torah la'olam morasha li'Yaakov, so that the Torah will always be an inheritance to Yaakov. U'lechol ha-nikahalim olav, and to anyone who wants to join in into his congregation. Who is that referring to? V'heim ha-gerim ha-nilvim al Hashem l'sharso. This is a reference to the converts who join in, Hanilvim al Hashem, who want to join on to Hashem and his people to serve him, the Nisbahu al Beis Yaakov, and combine themselves and attach themselves to the house of Yaakov, the Nikru Kulam, and they are all referred to Kehalaso. That is the congregation of Yaakov. So that the Ramban points out in this pasuk of Torah Tziva Lanu Moshe, in which we say, this is Lanu, this is ours. So much so that the Gemara in Sanhedrin says there's a prohibition from teaching Torah to a non-Jew. One is not allowed to teach Torah to a non-Jew. So much so the Gemara says that a non-Jew who learns Torah, and it's not referring to the written Torah but the oral law, is punishable by death. It's chayav misa. This is, and where does the Gemara derive that a non-Jew who learns Torah, Shebal Peh, who studies the Talmud or any of the other oral traditions that we have, is punishable by death? The Gemara says because it says Torah Tziva Lanu Moshe. Moshe taught us the Torah. It's a morasha. It's our inheritance. And it's only ours. You can't have it. So much so that's what the Gemara derives. And yet, the Ramban finds, but that's only if they remain non-Jewish while they're trying to learn our Torah. This is our Torah. It's not for anybody that just wants to learn it. This is our gift, our most precious commodity that we have, given to us by Hashem Himself, and it's ours, and we protect it as such. But somebody who wants to join in, somebody who wants to say, I want to be part of that nation, and converts and becomes part of us, the Ramban finds in that same exact pasuk, which we derive, that you're culpable of the death penalty for teacher, for a non-Jew who learns Torah, in that same pasuk we find a hint, says the Ramban, but if you want to become part of the Kahal, you want to become part of a larger congregation of Yaakov, then this is for you as well, and it will become forever for you as an inheritance as well. So both of those ideas are both within the very same pasuk of Torah Tziva, Lanu Moshe, Mora Shaki Hilas Yaakov, but it is inheritance for the entire congregation of the Jewish people. The Gemara also derives a fascinating halacha from the same theme. The Gemara says that if a Rebbe withholds a halacha from a student, a Rebbe has a certain halacha to teach, and for various reasons decides he does not teach it to his students, to his class, so that there's something which is in the Torah which they do not know because he withheld it. So the Gemara says he's a gazlan, he's a thief, because it's a morasha, it's an inheritance for all of the Kahal of Yisrael. And for you to know something and not to teach it to somebody, you're a thief, because it's yours, and it's yours, and it's yours, it's not mine. It's a morasha kihilas Yaakov. It is an inheritance for the entire congregation of the Jewish people. And from here also we have this beautiful idea that anybody who knows something and has the ability to teach it to somebody else and doesn't is considered a gazlan, is considered a thief, because you're withholding something which doesn't belong to you. It's not yours to hold on to. It's a great lesson. It's something which, if we really believe this, the idea of kiruv will not be left up to the rabbis to go out and teach Torah to the masses. Anytime a person came in contact with another Jew and you had something to share, you had something to teach, you had any piece of information, you would say, this is yours, I'm trying to give you that which is your inheritance. You don't realize how valuable it is, and I want you to have it. It's, you know, Rabbi Beryl Wein likes to say over in his history tapes, that when he moved to Florida, there was a certain Balabas, a certain member of the congregation who had received as an inheritance, I forgot what it was, one of the old Sefer that was written in the 1500s, the initial original print that was from the 1500s or 1600s. And so he said, hey Rabbi, you know, I got this from, you know, my great-grandfather, here you can have it. And he says over his tapes, it struck him as such a moment of, you only value what is valuable to you. Here is such a valuable commodity, the original print of, so here I am learning all these works all the time, and have an original that was studied for hundreds of years, and to this person, you know, it meant nothing. But the Torah is all of our inheritance. It's ours, it belongs to us. It's a Morah Shaki Hilas Yaakov. It's the inheritance of all of us, and it's our responsibility, the Gemara says, not just a Rebbe teaching his students, any Jew who has any knowledge of Torah, to be able to teach that to anybody else, not to do so is to be considered a gazlan and to withhold it. So I would conclude this part of the discussion with a Rambam. Maimonides writes that there are three crowns given to the Jewish people. There is the crown of Torah, there's a crown of kahuna, of priesthood, and there's the crown of malchus, of kingship. And the Rambam writes, and the crown of kingship was given to Aharon. It was given to Aaron the high priest, and his children and his children alone are the only children, the only members of the Jewish people who are zoicha, who are privileged to own and control the crown of priesthood. If you're not a Kohen, and your father's not a Kohen, then that's it. You're never going to be a Kohen, and you can't be a Kohen. It's just the way that it goes. They were privileged to the crown of priesthood, and that's how it goes. Kingship was given over to King David, to David HaMelech, and all of his descendants. If you're not descendant of David HaMelech, cannot be a king. Absolutely forbidden. In fact, the Gemara says that's why the Chashmonaim from the Hanukkah story were punished, because they were Kohanim, they were priests, and after the war, they established themselves as kings as well. And because they were not descended from David HaMelech, as obviously they could not be because they were Kohanim, which means they were descended from the tribe of Levi, they were punished so much so that the Gemara says within several generations there was not a single member of the house of the Chashmonaim that was left. Anyone who claimed they were descended from the Chashmonaim, the Gemara says, and then they were an Eved. they're a liar and they're a slave, because they couldn't possibly be, because they were wiped out entirely for claiming the throne when they were not allowed to. They were priests, but not kings. And the crown of kingship was given over to David and his descendants. But the crown of Torah, says the Rambam, Torah is munach, is laying there. V'chol mi sheba lirtza, anyone who wants to come, v'lamdo, who wants to learn it, is available to come and take it, because the pasuk says the Rambam, Torah tivalonu Moshe, Mora Shaki Hilas Yaakov. This is the inheritance of the entire congregation of the Jewish people, and there is no one who can claim, you're not of the right family, you're not of the right socioeconomic status. It doesn't matter. There's no, in Malchus and in Kahuna, that's true. There is that concept of a dynasty, and there's that concept of this an aristocratic system, that this is who gets it and nobody else. And Torah, says the Rambam, it is open and available to all. And the crown of Torah, says the Rambam, is the greatest crown of all. And again, based on this verse of Torah Tziva Lanu Moshe Mora Shaki Las Yaakov. That is all from there. I'll just throw in one more thought. The idea that we all know how many mitzvahs there are in the Torah? Anyone know how we know that? How did the sages know that number 613? What's the initial source? Tayag. Where did the number Tayag come from? So the Gemara learns it's from this pasuk, because the numerical equivalent of Torah, Tav is 400, Vav is 6, it's 406, Resh from the word Torah is 200, that's 606. And hey is 5, gives you a grand total of 611. So the Gemara says, Torah tziva lanu Moshe. Moshe taught us Torah. How much is Torah? 611. And the first two of the Aseres Hadibros, the sages say, were said by Hashem himself. So Moshe taught us 611. Torah tziva lanu Moshe. Moshe taught us Torah, 611. Two were taught by Hashem himself, and the first two of the Ten Commandments, to get a grand total of 613, and that's the source for that which we all know, that there are 613 mitzvahs, and then the later authorities came and tried to count and figure out how do we work that out, because if you did a simple count, there'd be many, many, many more than 613, but since the sages derived from this that there are 613 principles, or 613 prime mitzvahs, we'll then try to figure out the categories, how to count them to get exactly 613, but this pasuk is also the source of that. But all of that is within this magnificent pasuk of Torah Tziva Lanu Moshe Morasha Kilas Yaakov. Again, this is the first thing that we teach to our children. We learn the idea that a non-Jew is prohibited from learning Torah because it is Torah Tziva Lanu, it is only given over to us. We learn that if a person wants to convert, however, it is also for the Kihilas Yaakov, not just the children of Yaakov, but any of the congregation of Yaakov are open to have it. Any teacher who has something to teach and withholds it from another Jew is considered a thief for withholding the inheritance of its rightful owner. And we also have the concept of the crown of Torah belongs to all of us. Any single individual has the rights and the privilege and the authority to demand to be taught, because this crown belongs to all of the Jewish people, and no one has a right to say it is mine and not yours, even though we do have that concept by the priesthood and by kingship. All that is in that pasuk. Torah tziva lanu Moshe Morasha Kilas Yaakov. And finally, the last pasuk that Moshe says before beginning his actual blessings of the Jewish people is pasuk hey, Vayihi Vishur Melech. He became a king, referring to Hashem, became a king over Yeshurun, a reference to the Jewish people. And Vayihi Vishur Melech Behisasef Roshei Am. When did Hashem become king over Yeshurun? When did he become king over the Jewish people? When the numbers of the nation gathered, Yachad Shiftei Yisrael, the tribes of Israel in unity. Get another poetic pasuk, which basically says Hashem became king over the Jewish people when the numbers of the nation gathered together. People came together, and in unity were all the tribes together. As Rashi describes, it's on the top of page 1114. First Rashi, the first line, b'his'aftem yachad ba'aguda achas. When the Jewish people come together and literally in one bundle, when we're held together in one little clump together, v'shalom b'neihem, and there's peace between them, then hu malkom? then he's the king. When is Hashem king? When we as the Jewish people are together in unity, Hashem is our king. When there is dispute amongst the Jewish people, God is not our king. So that the ability of Hashem to be our king is entirely dependent on our ability to get along with each other. Because when is he Bishur and Melech? He's only a king, b'hisasev yachad. When the Shiftei Yisrael are together, is he king. And I want to share with you a magnificent medrash, which the sages describe this idea of how Hashem's kingdom is dependent on us. The medrash says, v'ahi Bishur Melech, quoting this very verse, when is Hashem king? Kishi Yisrael shovin be'etza achas milamata. When the Jewish people are in unity together with one strategy, with one thought process in this world down here, Shemo HaGodol Mishtabeach Milmala. His great name is praised up above. So when we are together here, His name is praised above. When the Jewish people are together, but not when there are the Lokishen Asuin Agudas Agudas, but not when they are in separate bundles, each one doing their own thing in separate little sects, so then you don't have any unity down here, you have no kingdom. And the Medrash, the Chazal say as follows, Moshul Adam, this is comparable to a person, Shevi Shtei Svinos, he brings two boats, Uksharan Behogden, and he ties the boats together with rope. The Hamid Ubona Alehim Paltarin. So you take two boats out to sea, and you can anchor them and tie them to each other, and he built a palace using those two boats as his foundation. So if you have two boats floating in the ocean, and a palace is built on top of them, the only way that palace can possibly stand and maintain itself is if the two boats remain tied together. As soon as those boats begin to sway from each other and to pull and to tug in different directions, by definition, a palace which is constructed on top of them will collapse and crumble underneath them as soon as those boats move apart. Says the sages, this is the way that Hashem built His kingdom. Kolzman shehasfinos kshuros, as long as the boats are tied together, palterin kayom, and His palace will remain intact and remain standing. Parshu hasfinos ein palterin kayom, and as soon as those boats sway from each other, they cut their ties, palace can't possibly stand. Kach kishi Yisrael osin ritzono shal makom. When we do the ratzon of the makom, the ratzon of Hashem, the will of Hashem, and are together be'achdus as one whole unified people, the kingdom of Hashem, Hashem will be king over the Jewish people. And I leave you with this thought as we go into Yom Kippur. Rosh Shlomo Volber writes about this in his discussion in preparing for Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. These are the days in which we declare, we say, Hashem is Melech, Hashem hu Moloch, Yimloch li'olam vo'ed. We declare Hashem king. And he writes, Hashem says over and over and over again, I'm king, you want to make me king, that's great. If you can't get along with the person next to you, don't declare me king, because I've told you how I work the system. I'm building my palace on your heads. When you guys are together, and you're standing next to each other with shalom, then my palace will stand. If you can't get along, well then you got to work on that first before you think that you can declare me a king. And he writes from the Arizal writes that before a person begins to daven, he needs to accept upon himself the mitzvah v'ahavta l'recha kamocha. You can't possibly think that you're going to daven and acknowledge Hashem as a king if you can't get along with the person next to you. If you can't say, I can fulfill the mitzvah of v'ahavta l'recha kamocha, I can love everybody in this shul like myself, not just in the shul, but even in the shul that you don't go to, that's even more difficult. But if you can't say that, then who do you think you're proclaiming king? There's no one who's listening to you because he's not interested. And he's told you what you need to do in order to declare him as a king. And he brings here a fascinating insight. I never saw this before until I saw it in his work. There's a custom sometimes you see when they start Kiddusha, and they say, Nekadesha Shemcha Ba'olam, we should sanctify your name, Kishem Shemach Bishim Osel Bishmeh Morom, the way that it's sanctified, the Karazel Zev, and you'll see people say, they'll bow to each other, they'll say, Zel Zev Omar, they'll seen that before? Yeah. Which they'll tell inside. So Rav Volber, you know why we do that? He says, because the words that we're saying are, we want to sanctify you here, Nikadesh Hashimcha, sanctify your great name here, Ba'olam, in this world, the same way that the angels, Keshem Shemach Bishim, also B'Shmei Marom, the way they're sanctifying you in heaven. What are they doing in heaven? In heaven, they're saying, Kadosh, 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 they're saying, you are holy. We, We're going to do the same thing down here. We are going to say the same thing. That's what Kedusha is about. That's why that phrase is the most powerful part of the Kedusha, which we say, Kadosh, 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 just like the angels, we're doing it too. So he writes, well, in the angels, he's Osa Shalom Bimromov. There's peace up in heaven. The angels aren't fighting. So he says, if you want to be able to talk like the angels and say, I'm going to declare you to be holy like the angels, well, look around and make sure that you're okay with everybody. So you say, Karazah, they call to each other. They call to this one, Karazah, Elzah, they call to that one, Amar, and then you can say, Kadosh, Kadosh, Kadosh. If you look around the room and you can say, I am at peace with everybody here, I am with Shalom, and there is Achdus amongst the Jewish people, then you can say, Kadosh, 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 because that's what Moshe's final words before he begins his blessing says, Yachad Shiftei Yisrael. When are you going to be able to say, Vayhi Bishur Mela? When are you going to declare Hashem King? Only if you're together. If you're not together, the boats are severed, there's no palace, there's nothing to talk about. And that is the foundation of these days, Yom Kippur Rosh Hashanah, before we could start working between man and God, our north-south relationship. You've got to make sure that your east-west relationship between the people sitting next to you and the people sitting in the other shuls and the other cities, that you're together with them, because without Achdus and the Jewish people, there will be no kingship of Hashem. And I think it is an unfortunate statement that speaks for itself in the unfortunate state of the Jewish world as it is right now, where we wonder how come Hashem hasn't revealed His kingdom and we're still in the exile. He'll say, I tell you why, because you guys can't get along with each other. When you learn to not to fight, and not to bicker, and not to hate each other, not to refuse to be in this one shul and that one shul, when you work it out, you'll see, my palace will magically appear on your shoulders. But as long as you guys are so far apart, I can't build my palace without the Jewish people together in unity. That is the final idea I share with you in the parasha, which is I think it works as a lead-in for Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, as we're about to approach that Shabbos Mirtz Hashem. And that's just the first few verses from this parasha. It's a packed parasha, but we'll do that. That's what we have time for this afternoon. A wonderful afternoon, a good Yom Kippur. Should be successful in Tshuva and in Kapara. And a good New Year for all.